Well, Bob Crane was telling me about a new website he's got called calamitykit.com. I'll tell you about that much later on in a few weeks. But he sent this along, and I was able to pick this up, which is so appropriate for tonight's program. I want to read you a portion of it. And this, again, is in Bob Crane's words. He says, "Most people do not have a clue that we will, without a question or without any reasonable doubt, have a near 8.0 earthquake in the next 100 years, somewhere in Alaska, Washington, Oregon, California, or the New Madrid Fault along the Mississippi River. Based on several articles I've read in the Credible Science News magazine, my own estimate, by adding up the odds, is that we have about a 30% chance of having an earthquake or other disaster happening in our lifetimes. A large quake or hurricane like Katrina is catastrophic if you're in the wrong place, and even more so if you're unprepared. As of this writing, FEMA does not have a complete plan for an earthquake disaster in California. The monetary toll from a large earthquake would be the biggest in history, and the effects will last for years, if not a decade. There will very likely be desperate and violent struggles for food and water in some areas. Humboldt County, California, where C. Crane is located, had three sizable earthquakes in 24 hours in 1992. The main shock was 7.1, followed by a 6.6 and 6.7. In one hectic nightmare moment, broken glass was everywhere. Nobody had shoes on. It was pitch black, and the only flashlight found was as dim as they come. Well, guess how C. Crane became involved with preparedness? I swore I would never be unprepared again. The population in Humboldt County is only 35 people square mile, but hundreds of homes were destroyed or had major damage. Almost 100 people were injured. A rough estimate of damage was $66 million. Compare this with unpopulated remote areas where we live, with the population density of Los Angeles at over 10,000 people per square mile. And these were little bitty quakes compared to the real one that will come someday. Tonight we're going to talk about these tectonic plates that seem to be shifting violently all around this planet and here in the United States with two special guests. They're next on Coast to Coast AM. Two guests for you tonight. Richard Mooney Jr. presently works at Howe Caverns as a geology guide. He graduated from the State University of New York at Albany in 1982, a master's in geology. Richard's work model presents over 35 years of experience that almost completes a puzzle we're going to talk about tonight. Richard Mooney there. Hey, Richard, how are you?
Good. How are you doing, George?
Good. It's good to have you with us tonight. Let me also introduce Bill Zabor. He's got a master's degree in mechanical engineering from Cornell University. He's got experience in the large corporate world, the defense industry, extensive experience as an investor and entrepreneur in the energy and environmental fields. He holds about 30 patents. He's the founder and CEO of Ovation Products, recently renamed Zanacqua, and the company has developed a small vapor compression distiller, which has broad applications in cleaning water for domestic and international use worldwide. He is the technical editor for Infinite Energy Magazine. He's with us tonight, too. Hey, Bill, how are you?
Hi, George.
Good.
Fine.
Now, Bill, let me ask you or Richard, which one of you know, because you're both associated with, of course, Infinite Energy Magazine and our dear friend Eugene Malov, of course, the founder. I know they had a suspect arrested a few years ago in that horrible murder. Did that ever go to trial? Do you know?
Well, I know they caught somebody and then they released them and they picked them up again. They released them the first time because they supposedly didn't have enough evidence.
You see, I never heard anything about a trial.
And I didn't either. And
yeah.
I don't believe there was a trial yet. It's dragged on and on and on.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
So the answer is still unknown.
Well, why don't we dedicate tonight's show to Gene Malov? You want to do that?
Sounds like a fine idea.
We will do that. Richard, let's bring you in, and Bill, we bring you in here, and we'll continue talking a little bit later on. We'll talk about alternative energy, which is, you know, somewhat related to what we're talking about today. Earthquakes. A number of earthquakes continue to hit this planet on a regular basis, but there have been some big ones. Did they finally, the Sumatra earthquake that set off that huge tsunami several years ago, did they finally elevate that? Because originally it was a 9.0, And if they did push it, they said that they were going to push it by another 30%. That would have made it the second largest ever. Did they ever do that?
Never heard any discussion of trying to upgrade. All I know is it was up around over 8, which is huge. And the only thing bigger than I can recall off the top of my head would be the Anchorage earthquake.
And there was one in Chile, too.
Right. Chile was, I think, about 8.5, as I recall, 8.4, yeah. Something like that.
Well, that was a big one, nonetheless.
It was a big one, for sure.
This planet, you know, I'm right here in the Los Angeles area right now, and it has been very quiet for a long time. That concerns me, Richard.
Well, it should, because one of the expressions that some seismologists use with respect to the subduction zone, where the big chunks of the planet dive back into the Earth's interior, they're what's called locked and loaded. Just because they're not out there cranking out the magnitude 4 or 5 earthquakes on a regular basis doesn't mean they're not going to crank out a big one at some point. For example, the New Madrid zone, nobody really expected that to be an active one, yet they had magnitude 8 earthquakes along the New Madrid around 1810. So it's pretty clear that we don't always know, based on precursors, smaller events, that they're not going to be bigger events, just more or less happening fairly suddenly.
And wasn't that Midwestern earthquake so big that it changed the direction of the Mississippi River for a while?
Absolutely. It flowed uphill for a while.
Oh, my gosh. Well, and is it better to get a lot of these little small ones? I mean, does that release tectonic pressure, or do wait for the big one?
Well, they can, but there's this process or value called the B value, where you have basically for every 10 earthquakes of magnitude 7 or 100 earthquakes of magnitude 6, you'll get 10 magnitude 7 and 1 magnitude 8. So as you start out at the lower end, there is this B value which says you'll get a lot more smaller earthquakes and much fewer bigger ones. But that whole process is kind of empirical. It's hard to say for sure how that relates to areas of the crust where things are happening. We know things are happening, but we're not sure what's going to happen when.
All right, let's get a little bit more information, Richard, you first, on just who you are.
I'm a geologist from upstate New York. I went to the State University of New York at Albany. At the time, we had probably the best plate tectonics department anywhere in the world. We had some of the top men in the field, John Dewey, Kevin Burke, and Bill Kidd, and other people, Jeff Fox, were all involved in being at the cutting edge of science when I first got there as an undergraduate. So it was very exciting to be there, but also it was also somewhat intimidating because we were basically thrust into a situation as undergraduates where we had no background. We're blank tablets. Mm-hmm. And to suddenly be exposed to these overarching theories, really grandiose theories with no background, was kind of not a good idea, because it kind of got you thinking this is what science was all about. Instead of learning the basics, we learn the big picture before we learn the small stuff.
Okay, and how about you, Bill? Tell us a little bit about you.
Well, I'm an engineer, a master's degree, as you pointed out, and I started out working in big corporations, including the military business, and gradually worked my way down to the point where I was the founder of the companies and an entrepreneur. And I've done that for about 30 years. In the energy business primarily, solar energy. I ran one of the biggest, probably the biggest solar energy company in New England for a while, and that was going well until 1985, when the tax credits disappeared and the price of oil was cut in half. I founded several other companies since, and the one I'm working on now is now called Zanacqua Technologies. That's I founded it about 10 years ago to develop a sort of a universal water treatment system.
Uh-huh.
So it's based on vapor compression distillation, which recycles over 98% of the energy so that it becomes cost-effective and can basically take sewage and make it potable. So it has huge potential for worldwide recycling.
Well, I'm convinced wars are going to be fought over drinking water, Bill.
Well, I think you're right, and I think our machine is going to become the water market worldwide is a $400 billion a year market, and we have a potential of being a big player in that market.
Regardless of whether you believe in the abiotic oil theory, a theory where the planet makes its own oil, or the fossil oil, we are taking it out of the planet, and we're taking it out fast. Does that, both of you think about this, does that affect some of these tectonic plates? I mean, are we literally taking away the oil that kind of greases these plates?
Not so much the oil. There are volatiles that can grease the plates. And one of the things we had here in New York State was one of the first laws dealing with the use of high-pressure salt solution, because it was discovered they could tie in these deep wells that they're using to extract salt. When they got overpressure, they start lubricating the faults enough, so they started getting some micro-earthquakes associated with the high-pressure salt injection or water injection.
The earthquakes and this quest for finding new energy sources, any relationship at all?
Well, certainly we know that we see evidence of cold fusion being operational in some areas where it's hard to say whether it applies to the Earth or not, but clearly we have to look at alternative ways to generate heat in the planet. And there are a number of new ways that people are thinking about that may actually have application to such things as better understanding geothermal energy, for example.
All right, let's get into these earthquakes and these tectonic plates. First of all, if you could tell us, Richard, in your opinion, in your definition, what are tectonic plates?
Well, in my opinion, it got off on the wrong foot, because the tectonic plates very early on were defined mathematically, because essentially people like to bring in math and science too early, before the concepts are known. And the minute you start quantifying process before you understand it, this kind of sets it in cement before the concepts are really known. So in the case of tectonic plates, people wanted to believe that they could define these things on a sphere and describe their motion mathematically. Well, once you start doing that, then people say, well, gee whiz, if we can define these things mathematically, what's the geology going to look like?
Right.
So it basically has a situation where you're defining the geology by math instead of the math defining the geology.
Now, these plates that are shifting on this planet, how deep are they?
Well, at the surface of the ocean, they're right at the surface, with a few kilometers down. Someplace in the continents, people believe they're extremely deep, several hundred kilometers deep. In the oceans, they're probably more shallower than that, probably up to about 100 kilometers, a little more than that.
Richard, I've heard stories, I don't know how true they are, that on some coastlines, whether it's the west or east coast, that the land kind of juts out into the ocean, but that underneath it, the ocean could go in for hundreds of miles inside, underneath the landmass, almost like, we're basically sitting out on top of nothing. Is that possible?
Unlikely. We have enough seismic evidence to more or less collect the data from the surface all the way down to great depth. If you had that kind of water extending inland, it would affect the seismic structure. But now that you mention it, one of the most exciting discoveries they've made recently about water is a big chunk of water deep in the planet the size of the Bering Sea they've discovered, which is something phenomenal. Nobody believes that there could be that much water at depth, but apparently there's a large slug of water sitting at great depth.
And how do they find that?
Seismically. The seismic waves pick up the fact that you've got this very low-density body sitting in the middle of high-density material, and they theorize it's probably water.
Are these plates constantly shifting and moving?
Yes. Basically, you're talking about slow-moving, intermediate moving, and fast moving. The slow ones are the ones that we have, what we call the Atlantic, would be considered a slow moving plate. By that I mean it moves perhaps, separates perhaps maybe an inch or so, a couple of inches a year.
Okay.
Where the large, faster ones, the Pacific, much perhaps four or five times that rate.
The Sumatra one literally cracked part of the ocean floor, didn't it?
Absolutely. When you're getting, what you got to recognize, not all earthquakes affect the sea the same way. if you get just the right configuration, as you got with the Sumatra earthquake, you have just the right ability to move enough landmass up or down, which caused the water to move up or down. But if you take the same landmass and slide sideways, it won't have the same effect. Even though the earthquakes may be the same magnitude, it matters a great deal whether land is going up or down as opposed to sideways.
With all this incredible technology, aside from elephants that run inland and other animals, why can't we have a good earthquake detection before it happens?
Well, that's largely due to a misdirection of our resources. We have not viewed saving lives as important as other projects that don't have a return on investment. I would specify, for example, neutrino research, which was a $1 billion project to study particles that may not even exist, when that same $1 billion, if expended in geology, probably could have saved 100,000 lives in Indonesia. By saying that, what I mean is, if we had had ocean bottom seismometer, accelerometers on the seafloor throughout the Pacific, and an early warning system set up in the Pacific, much of what happened in Indonesia wouldn't have happened.
What about the predictor, though, Richard? Is there any kind of technology out there that would give us days notice that an earthquake is going to hit?
Well, the Chinese have had success. They maybe it was sheer luck, but they actually evacuated a city in China before an earthquake hit, and they saved several thousand lives by doing it. May have been luck. We don't really know, because right now, earthquake prediction, again, a lot of it is just a question of funding. We don't view it as significant enough compared to our defense budget, you name it. It's not a high priority. We're so worried about terrorism right now, we don't seem to recognize that a big earthquake in California could cause maybe several hundred billion dollars in damage, tens of thousands of lost lives. We're so focused on the media more or less concentrating our attention on certain topics, they sort of fall by the wayside. They fall by the wayside. They don't get funding. You don't get funding, you'll get results.
You know, Richard, I'm really concerned, obviously, coming from St. Louis, where the New Madrid is up, and also this Yellowstone caldera that I want to spend a lot of time with you and Bill to talk with both of you about. That, if that goes, and it's overdue, I mean, you're talking about a calamity of worldwide devastation.
That's absolutely true. Well, people look at Mount St. Helens as a big, big event, but put in perspective, when the Columbia River flood basalt occurred about 15 million years ago, the volume of the Columbia River flood basalt was 200,000 times the volume of Mount St. Helens.
My gosh. Has the planet slowed down from its earlier infant days?
Well, it's slowed down, but it also slowed down. Some people because of what's called tidal drag, as the moon goes around, slows down the Earth's rotation. But another fellow I'm involved with in physics cosmology claims that his new theory of the universe may explain it as well. So we're looking at a lot of complex interacting factors, because among other things, during the Cretaceous, there's what's called an avalanche towards the core, when a large mass of dense material headed towards the core, which tended to cause, like a skater, when she swirls around, brings her arm down to by her side, she speeds up. Well, that happened to the planet, apparently, because a large slug of cold material headed to depth, and like the skater bringing her arms into her side, this caused the whole Earth to speed up. And as a result, days were shorter, but the number of days in the year increased.
The websites, of course, are linked up at coasttocoastam.com with our two special guests tonight, Bill Zabor and Richard Moody. We're dedicating this program tonight in honor of our late dear friend Eugene Malov, who was working on cold fusion, and I truly believe might have gotten very close to it. And he's not with us anymore, tragically killed several years ago. We'll be back. We're going to talk about some specific areas of these tectonic plates and where some of the trouble spots can be and how can you protect yourself. And then we'll also get into some alternative energy discussions. Then we'll open up the phone lines right here on Coast to Coast AM. Indeed, indeed, with our guests tonight as we talk about earthquakes and what are you going to do about it. And there are some big ones. I want to tell you about the After Dark newsletter, where you get 14 issues for the price of 12. They're great issues. They're all about everything. Strange, paranormal, unusual, science. Call 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, Richard Moody. Richard, let's talk a little bit. We're going to take some time to talk about some earthquakes here, and then we'll get in next hour with some of the alternative energy with Bill. Are there any trouble spots here in the United States that you're concerned about the most?
Well, the most, again, the classic is California, because one of the things my model I'm working on would suggest is that we don't know exactly where we are in terms of how rapidly things are changing with respect to the overall plate. In other words, are they speeding up? Are they slowing down? Is it steady state? We see evidence, for example, that there are some very rapidly moving plates west of California right now on the East Pacific Rise. However, that may be a good thing for California, because if it's good, it would mean we've reached the upper limit of how fast the plates are going to get converging, and therefore the earthquakes are going to get much worse. It may be a reduction in seismic over the long run. However, there's some evidence from the marine geology which would suggest that the plate boundaries may be reorganizing now, which might indicate that they were about to speed up. We don't really know.
Okay, so so California, of course, I have gotten several emails from people who claim to be psychically inclined, and they think a huge one is on the way. One of them thought it might have happened about a month ago. It has not. In your opinion, over the next 6 months to a year, what do you think?
That's probably the most difficult time window, because earthquakes are just the opposite of forecasting weather. Forecasting weather, you've got great accuracy when you're a few days in. The longer you extend it out, the worse the weather forecasts get. With seismology, just the opposite. Long-term forecasts are excellent. We know, for example, the big one's going to hit eventually. Where it gets tough is when you start reducing the time window more and more and more, trying to get specifics, because simply put, we don't have the kind of data collection along California that we need to even make that kind of determination. We do know we can see how fast the rocks are being squeezed together, pulled apart. We can measure things such as volatiles coming out to give us some idea what's happening. But the simple fact of the matter is the kind of money necessary to make earthquake prediction a reality is just not there. I mean, we really need a huge increase to even come close to having the kind of database we need to do it.
So really, it's anybody's guess.
Exactly.
I mean, how safe are people? I mean, here in L.A., you know, I've been here 4.5 years now, but I don't know how these skyscrapers have been built. Definitely not like Japan. Are they safe?
Well, you're talking about seismic loading. Typically, the skyscrapers do have harmonic dampers, which means that they're good up to a point. Essentially, as long as you're within the travel of the dampers, you can think of this as a spring which can go up and down a certain amount, but eventually, if you exceed the travel of the spring, it no longer is a spring, it becomes a steel rod. So if you've got seismic loading up to a certain level, the skyscraper will take it. But if you exceed the travel of their dampers, then you're out of luck.
Yeah, but it's coming.
Well, it's coming. The question is how big, how soon, who's going to be impacted. If we had the capacity to know ahead of schedule when these big ones were going to hit, it might be possible even someday to evacuate the villages or cities of Los Angeles and San Francisco and surrounding areas, build these 10 cities, and then more or less shut down the power, shut down the electricity, shut down the power, water, and other kinds of natural gas lines into the city so you don't have the fires. And then essentially lubricate the falls, let them rip, and then rebuild the cities when you're done. So even though the infrastructure may be damaged severely, the loss of life could be reduced substantially.
God, Richard, can you imagine the undertaking to evacuate Los Angeles or San Francisco?
It's enormous. But the alternative is to let a magnitude 7-plus earthquake rip right through them when people are living there.
Well, yeah, let me ask you this. You know, we just had a 4.2 in San Francisco Bay.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this. Let's use Los Angeles. If in the heart of Los Angeles, 7.5 hits, what could we expect?
Well, it pretty much depends on what you're on. If you're on unconsolidated sediments, and you've got a lot of houses with foundation and unconsolidated sediments, they can become quick under seismic loading. And that's what happened with the Anchorage, Alaska earthquake, where you had a situation where you had permafrost on top of mud that was unconsolidated, and big chunks of the earth just took off, sliding on, essentially on soup. And certainly in the San Francisco earthquake of 1906, you definitely had a real problem with building out over the bay and, you know, using unconsolidated fill more or less to support buildings, which is a bad idea. If you're on rock, you'll have less problem than you are if you're on unconsolidated sediment. So it depends a lot what kind of response you're going to get in terms of how the foundation of the buildings are attached. Are they attached to unconsolidated sediments, or are they attached to solid rock? That makes a big difference.
All right, well, let's look at it both ways. All right, if it's just on the sediment, are we talking about a disaster?
Well, no matter where you are, it depends entirely on the magnitude of the seismic load. And one of the things I indicated in my article is if we have a surging episode and we're looking at the beginning now as opposed to this being the end of a surge, which may be the case, if it's the start of a surge, within 100 years, I predict you won't have a single masonry building left standing. Because the difference between a surge and a non-surge, if we're at the beginning of a surge and we go from convergence of, say, 10 centimeters per year to 20, that may seem like a doubling of the rate of loading, but actually it's not arithmetic. It's exponential, so that if you had think of it this way. If you have a chunk of rock, like a spool between scissors, if you squeeze on the scissors, the spool, even though the scissors come together only a tiny amount, the spool itself may go forward a lot more. So if you think of California as kind of like a scissors with a spool of thread, even though the rate of convergence might only be a slightly greater amount, maybe half again or twice, the amount of energy shed on the fault might be far more than the doubling of the actual convergence.
Sounds like one of those situations, Richard, where we just have to hope for the best and, hope that this thing doesn't happen in our lifetime, even though I think that's pretty doubtful.
Let me give you a classic example of misdirection of resources, I feel. People are worried about asteroid impact and the fact that every 100 million years there's going to be a planet killer. Well, I got news for the residents of California. You're far more likely by a factor of 1,000 to die from an earthquake or a volcano than you are from asteroid impact. So to spend all these resources trying to track down these asteroids in space when we could be spending the same resources trying to figure out whether earthquakes are going to hit. I mean, I just look at the fact that we lost 100,000 people in Indonesia because we had an earthquake there and no early monitoring system throughout the Pacific because there's no funding for it. So I'm looking at the misdirection of funding as a major cause of us not being prepared for having better earthquake models and better earthquake prediction than we have now.
These big earthquakes, Richard, how long? I've never been in one. How long do they last as they, do their thing?
Well, the ground shaking, depending on how long and how much you're looking at. If you're talking about a fault which might be 1,000 kilometers long, but when it's magnitude 8 rips along a boundary, maybe 1,000 kilometers long, you'll get ground shaking for over a minute.
That's a lot,
yeah. And one of the problems with buildings is if they're not skyscrapers, just normal buildings, individual buildings will react differently. I don't know if you ever heard of Galloping Gertie, this bridge in the, I think it was Oakland, where the harmonic set up with the wind, and this bridge literally shook itself to death because it had a harmonic response. Well, the same thing happens with buildings. If you don't get seismic loading exactly correctly, then what happens, you can get reinforcing harmonics, so the thing gets back and forth and back and forth. Next thing you know, it may not even be a big earthquake, but if you get the right kind of reaction to the building, it'll fall down. So you really, it's hard to say how each individual structure is going to respond to the seismic loading, but it may change dramatically depending on how the, basically the way the building itself responds to the shaking.
Man. But Yellowstone could be a factor, and I think the sleeper is the Midwest with the New Madrid Fault.
I think you got a good point there. Again, it's the ice pick. You never know what's going to hit when. As I say, I've heard the seismologists refer to the subduction zones as locked and loaded, meaning they could tear loose at any time. We just don't have the data, the base level information, because the recurrence level of some of these major faults is so sporadic that some places, for example, New Madrid, if you have an earthquake every 100 years, it's tough to come up with a recurrence level that you can identify and say, well, this is going to happen in X number of years in the future. And you really don't have enough base level information to make that kind of prediction.
There's a fellow, I think he's dead now, his name was Sanderson.
Yeah.
And he had predicted a huge earthquake in the Midwest area, and that was back in 79-80, right around then. It never happened.
Problem with predictions, because simply that if you have enough people making predictions, if you have 1,000 people making predictions about when the next big one's going to happen, chances are somebody's going to be right. So you really have to look at it as to batting average. If somebody came up with a prediction and they were right 3 times out of 4, that would have a lot more credibility than, say, 1,000 people guessing and somebody getting it right.
4 areas where the damage of earthquake occurs: the strength of the shaking, the length of it, the type of soil, as you've been mentioning, and the kind of building. So generally,
building codes are critical. For a long time in New York, for example, New York City, there's not a lot of building codes where they're more worried about wind load than seismic load. And as a result, not a lot of the old structures are not really designed to withstand any kind of significant ground shaking, which is important because the Ramapo Fault is near enough to New York City. If that even uncorks a magnitude 5 or 5.5, that would be enough to cause significant damage in New York City.
Have you ever heard of cases where the earth cracks, and I mean it's thousands of feet deep?
Not of that deep, but I've certainly in Anchorage, you've got massive kinds of fault, big fissures opening up, and there are examples of people falling in, that sort of thing, and cows and so forth. But these fissures probably don't extend down far enough and long enough that they're a problem, but certainly there are fissures that go down, that continue down as breaks in the rock for miles in some cases.
Now, what about the volcanoes? What's the potential problem spots for that?
Well, put in perspective, the Long Valley Caldera compared to Mount St. Helens, which was a cubic kilometer of material, Long Valley Caldera is about 32 kilometers long, 17 kilometers across, and several kilometers deep. So again, compared to, say, Mount St. Helens, if you compare it, would be Mount St. Helens would be a firecracker, and the Long Valley Caldera would be a 5-pound stick of dynamite. So it's a big difference.
In the work you're doing, Richard, I mean, are you getting noticed? What are your colleagues saying?
Well, I haven't gotten noticed. I just got the article just came out this past week, so we're still waiting. It's as the saying goes, hot off the press. And it's more or less a bombshell in the middle of geology. It's tough to say what the results are going to be. It's hard to know whether it's going to be accepted or not accepted. But one of my things I'm confident about is some of the theories I've come up with are so obvious and the data set's so good that I think it's going to be accepted probably sooner than most big changes in thinking occur. Among other things, this is the first major new model is, to the best of my knowledge, in the internet, post-internet revolution. So information flow is so much faster now. A theory that might take 20 years to get accepted 50 years ago the rate of information flow is so much more rapid and there's so much more widely disseminated that the exceptions might occur faster than you might expect.
Are other scientists coming up with the same theory?
No, my theories are sufficiently new that basically what I've done is taken two sets of geology thinking, one that things happen slowly, and one school says things happen fast. And I more or less combined the two and said, well, for most of the time, things happen slowly. But then every so often, all hell breaks loose and things happen fast. So it's basically the flip side of the same coin. You're looking at things happening what's more or less steady state for a while, and then every so often you catastrophism where things happen rapidly. And we don't know where we are on that scale right now.
So I'm looking at these largest recorded earthquakes. We've got the one in 1960 in Chile, 64 in Alaska, 57 in the Aleutians, 52, and then 2004, the one in Indonesia, Sumatra. Mm-hmm. So many years, 40 years go by, 50 years go by before we get a huge one like this. What took so long?
Well, it's hard to say. I'll give you an example of how little we know about seismology. A big earthquake occurred off Boston in 1755, which a magnitude earthquake of that, or an earthquake of that magnitude would have a profound impact on Boston. 17 days apart, there was another massive earthquake occurring opposite Lisbon. What makes this interesting is they lie on more or less the same flow line.
Uh-huh.
In other words, if you go on opposite sides of the Atlantic, you say, well, they lie along the same flow line. Now, is that a boundary? We don't know, because obviously if you get earthquakes of that magnitude, there's obviously a lot of stress building up. Why? It's in the middle of a plate. Why are we getting these kind of earthquakes in the middle of a plate? Because according to plate theory, that doesn't make sense.
Good point. So if you lived here in California, would you be running for the hills?
Frankly, I wouldn't. I would be sufficiently concerned. I live in upstate New York, where I have not a lot of risk either from driving or any other kind of risk from any real problems as far as the kind of natural disaster you guys get out there. But I would be sufficiently concerned that I would find it very disquieting to live in an environment where I knew that there's one chance out of maybe four or five that during the course of a lifetime in California, I'd have to deal with an earthquake of magnitude 7 or 8. That would be enough concern to me to say, well, odds and probability are the longer I live in California, the greater the likelihood I'll be there when the magnitude 7 or 8 earthquake strikes. But people accept risk.
And how many people are really prepared, Richard?
Probably very few. Well, we have some capacity to deal with short-term events. But again, as we saw with Katrina, the simple, overwhelming nature of a natural disaster of the kind that would strike California with, say, a magnitude 8 earthquake would be so massive that there would be no relief efforts that could begin to deal with all the problems that they would have. When you start losing all your hospitals, you start losing all your electricity generating capacity, your sewage treatment plants, everything like that just goes under, same way it did with Katrina. This could take a long time to pick up the pieces.
I think it will. But keep up the fine work, and you need to get a hold of a friend of ours named Jim Berkland. Do you know Jim at all?
No, I don't.
Jim's a former geologist. They bounced him because he made earthquake predictions. Can you believe that?
I don't believe it. Yeah, we had a fellow at SUNY Albany who also made predictions based on astrology.
Yeah, well, Jim predicts because of disappearing animals and lunar in perigees. He looks at the full moon. And, you know, he's been right quite a bit.
Well, the triggering mechanism of gravity, the Earth, the moon's pull, certainly can have an impact on when you trigger these things. Obviously, you have to build the stress first, and you need a trigger mechanism, and certainly that could be one of them.
We'll be back in a moment. We're going to check in with Bill Zabor as we talk about some alternative energy in this twofold related topic tonight. And then we'll open up the phone lines pretty soon as well, and give you a chance to jump on board. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.